Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and gastronaut. Today, we're starting with a question. What's the best food industry innovation since sliced bread? Now, the bread slicing machine was invented in the late 1920s in the USA and was initially met with some scepticism by consumers. But it's a huge success story. Within 5 years of that first slicing machine being used in a Missouri bakery, it's estimated that 80% of bread sold in the US was pre-sliced. It's an invention that changed the food industry, much like the invention of the Chorleywood bread process here in the UK. So what does it take to invent such game-changing ideas and make them succeed? Is it genius? Is it luck? Or are they somehow just inevitable as society develops? There are so many remarkable food industry innovations to look back at, and here to illuminate us and pick out the very best from the last 100 years or so are two absolutely fantastic guests. Dr. Morgan Gay is a food futurologist. She's passionate about the trends in society, behaviour, belief and history that go into our wonderful food culture. Hello there, Morgan. How are you doing?
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. We've also got Dr. Neil Buttery. He's an evolutionary biologist and food historian. He's obsessed with historical and traditional British food. And he's a friend of the podcast, having appeared in our episode on the dark history of sugar. Hello there, Neil.
Hello there. Thank you very much for having me on again.
Ah, it's a great pleasure. Okay, now our starting point is sliced bread. So let's have a little think about that before we move on. So Morgan, I mean, pre-sliced bread really has had a big impact on how we eat. Where would you place it though in a list of all-time innovations? Is it something you think about when you think about the building blocks of food culture? Maybe in comparison to the invention of the Chorleywood bread process, for example.
I don't think it's very high in the list of food innovation because I don't think it's made a difference to anything more than a little bit of convenience. And I think there's a lot of other things which are much more key to us being able to have the food we want and for it to be fresh. I think that's the biggest thing, is that over the last 100 years, it's actually changed. Our food landscape has changed so much in that time that I don't think our great-great-great-grandparents would even recognise where we are now. And I think a lot of that has come from process, it's come from food science and added ingredients, perhaps, preservatives, I would say, and ways of preserving, like canning or flash freezing, things like that. So I would put the sliced bread, which is a great term, quite low on the list of food innovation, how it's changed our eating landscape.
Yeah. Neil, I suspect you've got the same. I saw you nodding. I mean, obviously our listeners won't have seen that nodding, but you were nodding. I mean, the phrase, the best thing since sliced bread, I've always thought it's a little bit odd. You know, what about the best thing since the dishwasher or since pickling or the fridge? I mean, or do you think otherwise? Do you rate the bread slicer?
Well, no, I don't, is the short answer. First of all, it predates the Chorleywood process. So let's say it's real bread, more real bread. compared to the Chorleywood process. Slicing up a loaf is just going to make it go stale quicker. I wonder how much time did we spend slicing bread?
Oh, it's an onerous task, isn't it, that bread slicing? I quite enjoy slicing bread myself.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, I was thinking about this, and we've all lost our skills. Have you seen some people try to slice a loaf of bread that this mangled thing
comes out? Some quite famous chefs, yeah, their knife work on telly is not what it's cut out to be.
So why
has the concept of sliced bread become the thing that has been such a great invention? Why do we use that phrase, I wonder?
It's always a marketing phrase. I can't remember particular names, but I know it was a slogan. So we were told it was the best thing since sliced bread.
Very good.
So it's the magic of advertising.
Muppets, we just believe what they said. Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
There's a lot of things like that have become truths in our culture that are just marketing things, a bit like the milk marketing board pyramid from the 1950s.
Yes, absolutely.
Which was always about, you know, got milk, got to have milk, milk's a good thing. But it was, and that triangle that we still sometimes see with, you know, this is what you should have a lot of, this is what you should have a little bit of, is just marketing.
I can see so what which bread. Way this podcast episode is going now. It's going to be
skeptics.
Marketing skeptics. But then that's interesting as well. So that's not a problem. Now, I mean, we're talking about convenience and I mean, let's stop with the bread bit, and maybe Chorley Wood as much as the bread slicing machine. Have these things actually had negative aspects to them as well? Morgan, maybe starting with you.
Gosh, I mean, I think one of the things that's happened over this period of time, I wouldn't say maybe 100 years, but definitely the last 40 years, is that I think we've become more disconnected from our food process. And so, like you just said about people slicing bread, there's actually something that connects us to our food when we have to be involved in it. So during lockdown, we saw a lot of people being more involved because they were making bread, perhaps for the first time, it became a bit of a fad. So I think that that's one of the things that's happened. And so in that slicing process and then the bagging process of that, then it becomes something that's a lot more almost pre-made. Everything's exactly the same size. The preservatives are what stop it from going stale because it's sliced. When you actually buy a freshly baked loaf or you make one yourself, you know that as soon as you slice it, it does go stale pretty quickly, but a sliced loaf doesn't really. Then, of course, all of that's the. And I think we've just come away from real food. And I think part of that is that sliced bread thing.
Now, Neil, the concept of real food, it's a difficult idea, isn't it? Now, I remember back in the 90s, you know, I spent a fair amount of my time unemployed and I spent a fair amount of my time as a student. I needed that Tesco's economy 19p. I remember it was 19p sliced bread. It was really important. If I didn't have that, I probably wouldn't have eaten enough food. But at the same time, Morgan's right, isn't it? We've sort of lost the concept of what food is and where it comes from as well. I mean, how do you balance things like that?
Well, I think where our food now is built on a foundation of a kind of a false economy that we're told isn't a false economy, and we're also sold the idea that we don't have any time to do any of these things. And I think with lockdown, I mean, it's fair enough, we have lost a lot of skills. You know, I'm a self-taught chef. I didn't have somebody to show me the various cues and skills in making a loaf of bread or whatever. You know, I've had to learn all that myself. But I'm into it. I was interested in it, so I was happy to spend the time doing that. But with COVID, people had the time to get a few of the skills back again, and I think a bit of the pleasure back again into doing things in the kitchen. Because once you can do something, it is relaxing, and you realise, hang on a minute, it's not like I have to trade off an hour of watching my favourite show to doing some labour in the kitchen. It's like, oh no, this is better than watching my show.
It's my time in the kitchen.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, we do live in a time actually where there is such a thing as spare time, and that's just a recent thing.
Yeah. I mean, some people talk about not having enough time to do cooking, as you say. I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but I don't have enough time to watch TV. I'm too busy cooking and noodling about in the kitchen and chatting and stuff. I'm not saying I'm a marvellous character in any way, but it's just about how you slice up your time. Or, well, unless you're working three jobs and you've got kids to look after.
Yeah, I mean,
like that,
I don't have any kids. No, I don't realise. You know, I'm speaking from a different position than a lot of other people. Yeah, but, you know, I think it's people. I think people do want that in their lives. And I do think there's a certain amount of energy and effort put in by advertisers to say, no, you don't have time to do this. This stuff is unachievable.
Well, Eat, for instance. You know, don't bother cooking, just eat.
And it's odd, you know, the technology in our kitchens is getting more and more advanced. You know, it's amazing gadgets that do everything for you. And at the same time, we're probably getting food that's more processed, more of it's done ahead of time. We've got this amazing technology just to shove a frozen pizza in an oven. It's nuts.
Yeah, yeah. What you need to spend your money on is a fantastic knife, really. And then
one, yes. That's, I am always saying that. A knife and a sharpener, that's all you need.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
I just think it's that people think that what they, you know, it hasn't been passed down for generations, so some people don't know about cooking.
Yeah.
But I think it's also that people don't realise everything else that's lost by not doing it, because it's not just the time, it's about the satisfaction. And I think that's the thing that came up during COVID, is that people started reevaluating their meaning about what actually matters in our lives, because suddenly a lot of the kind of the glitz or the sparkle or the distraction was stripped away. And then we start realizing that it's people, it's sharing, it's coming together. And a lot of the stuff, I mean, Neil will know more about this than me, but I think definitely the 1950s, 60s in the US, maybe 70s in the UK, 80s, you know, it was that freeing women from being tied up to the kitchen was packet meals, ready meals, you know, the advert that was makes a dishonest woman of you. I think it was Festa Curry or something like that. So suddenly you had packet meals and women were suddenly liberated. And it's gone so far that that liberation has become, I think, something that is, we're just filling it with other stuff that's probably less meaningful and less wholesome. Yeah. It's a terrible word, but that kind of, you know, the core values of humanity, family, meaning. Mm.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right, of course. And but you know, fast forward a few decades, and we're in, well, I hope, in more enlightened times. You know, people are more free to make choices. You know, and hopefully, you know, in your household, what, you know, there's all sorts of different ways households work and how they're made up, but you know, hopefully one person can actually do those things that, you know, no one's chained to a kitchen anymore. They can, you can divide up the jobs now, you can make it
speak
less
for yourself. And my family won't let me get out of the bloody kitchen. It's a nightmare. so Morgan, I mean, famously you say that you're not a great cook, and I wonder, has COVID changed that a little bit for you? Did you get down to work a bit?
Well, I'm not a chef.
Oh, okay.
I'm a cobbler. Okay. You know, I'm not a recipe follower. I've always cooked. I spend a lot of time in the kitchen, but I think I spend a lot of time chopping. I'm a chopper of things, but I'm not a gourmet. I think I prefer simplicity. So that's probably, and I think recipes for me are always a bit restricting, and I'm a little bit more experimental. So I can make a great meal, but it's haphazard. It might happen once. If you ever want that same meal again, it's never going to happen. So it's unfortunately,
that's why you're so dangerous with your independent thinking. We don't like that at all. So let's move on to talking about food innovations. So let's put the bread slicer aside. Let's talk about the great things over the last 100 years. I mentioned the fridge and the dishwasher. I suppose dishwasher isn't really about food, but it sort of helps the process. Frozen peas, fantastic stuff. Neil, what would you say are the building, not the building blocks, but the exciting and fundamental things that have changed food and cooking and eating over the last 100 years?
Well, I mean, frozen peas. You mentioned, well, I suppose, well, freezing and flash freezing is one of the
flash
major
freezing, yes.
ones.
And why is that so good?
Well, from the point of view of the humble pea, I think it represents quite a few different things, actually. First of all, it's a great product. It's probably that sweet corn and soft fruit, I would say, are the real successes of freezing, flash freezing. Mm. You know, peas are hyper-seasonal. I mean, they used to be. I mean, we get more year-round now from Kenya or whatever. But they were hyper-seasonal. They, as soon as they get past a couple of days old, they start turning all the sugar into starch to become, you know, marrow fat peas. They use it, you know, what you make for soup. It's obviously starchy. Or if you pick them straight away, they start turning to starch as well. That speeds up. So if you want fresh peas and it's taking just a few days to get to market, what you've got really is something in between a fresh pea and a marrow fat dried pea. So the fact that these things were being picked and frozen within an hour, blanched, I think, and frozen within an hour, means all the nutrients are there, all the sugars are there. And if you wanted that previously, well, you had to have your own market garden or something, so your own kitchen garden or something like that. It was extremely expensive, really high in nutrients. It doesn't get rid of any nutrients. It's just a remarkable thing. And then when refrigeration got cheaper, it meant that everybody could have this essentially fresh food, absolutely packed full of nutrients, that just sit there in a corner of your fridge for months and months and months and doesn't degrade.
Yeah, which is extraordinary.
You know, I think it's a fantastic, absolutely fantastic invention. And, you know, you can get all vegetables like that as well, but they all taste a bit weird. You mean frozen
peas
carrots.
Really cracked it, hasn't it?
And,
yeah.
But the peas are absolutely great. You just got to show them a bit of hot water and they're done because they're already soft.
I drove a pea harvester once. It was possibly the best day of my life. I nearly exploded with excitement.
When you talk,
Morgan.
Yeah. I was just going to say about the frozen thing, because I think that it's really changed the fish industry.
Ah, yes, absolutely.
Because the difference with a bad pea is maybe just a bit starchy, but a bad fish is... having a fishmonger's, I think, is really a hard business, because that turnover, if you don't sell it, you haven't got long. And I never can... I just think it's a really hard business to be in. I think something about frozen fish makes things a lot more accessible and easy for the producer, for the person buying it, who don't use it that day. Something about fish for me and freezing is like a match made in heaven.
So in a sense, we're not talking about the product as much as the technology behind it. I mean, the refrigeration and development of it and all of the steps that had to go through. And Morgan, so other than freezing, any other products or innovations or foods that you can dig out? I mean, it doesn't have to be the last 100 years. It could be the last 10 years.
Thing that I hate, but I think it's changed the face of the way that people cook, is the microwave.
Yeah.
I don't have a microwave. But I know that most people do. And
what have you got against microwaves?
Yeah, just I think of cooking in terms of hierarchy of cooking. And I think cook over the fire. That's great if you can do that. That's like number one. You know, it goes. And I think the last level would be microwave.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not the tool. It's what you use it for. What it implies in your food culture, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I just feel. I know that it's great for so many things, and it really speeds up so many processes. And it's especially if you've got a big family and you're trying to juggle things. And I have no kind of judgment on people who've got a microwave, and I think good for you. My dad's got one. I can't even work it. Every single thing is always so difficult with beeping. I'm like, oh, God, I don't know. Just every single one's different. They're just annoying. But
absolutely. But now, I mean, this sort of brings up the concept, and I'm not saying that this is a problem for you, Morgan, but neophobia, you know, the idea that something new is not so good or possibly dangerous. You know, when the potato first arrived in the UK after the Columbian Exchange, it didn't actually take on for a couple of hundred years because everyone was terrified of it. It was like it was a witch's brew product. And is there, Neil, I mean, in food history, a sort of a trail of events? I would say that the dishwasher was probably leapt upon by people, but is there a fear of developments and foods? And I think I completely get what Morgan says, saying that the microwave itself is a fantastic tool. It just implies something that she doesn't really want in her food.
Yeah, well, I would say that these things ebb and flow. Mm. We go through these periods where we really want innovation. So whether that's new technologies or whether it's foods from around the world, and we go up or down depending on your personal point of view, let's say up, and then people just suddenly go, hang on a minute, wait, we've forgotten who we are, where we're from, what about this amazing traditional food cooked in traditional ways, we need to bring it back. People begin to panic, and it happened in the 1920s. There's a huge amount of effort put into finding our traditions, in inverted commas. Traditions only have to be done once or twice before the tradition. Sometimes, you know, they're not as tradition as you think, but what we think of as traditions anyway. It happened in the 1990s. People were very obsessed. It was all about British food, two fat ladies, Gary Rhodes. You know, it's really, really important. I would say maybe 10 years ago, it wasn't. It was all about pulled pork, if I think. Thinking about
a lot
years
of
ago.
Walk around, it's true.
But I think now we're going to a point where we're wanting to get our traditional food and identity back. So I think we're in that peak trough, depending, like I say, on your outlook.
Yeah, absolutely. And Morgan, go.
I was going to say, but I always think that when we're looking at what we think is traditional, it's often about nostalgia
and romanticism.
And I think we always want that nostalgia when we're in a crisis or in an economic slump. So I think right now nostalgia is huge. And but that said, I think that generally the food. I mean, because I'm a futurologist, you know, and bizarrely, I think that innovation is fantastic. I'm always excited about the future. I think that we are always, as humanity, we see a mountain, we want to climb it, we want to find the next thing. But that gives us a choice, and then we can make a personal choice: do we want that innovation or not? I think most people are afraid of change and afraid of the future, really. Because the past is something that's secure, and that's why we tend to, especially when we're feeling destabilized like now, people want to look back and kind of latch onto a supposed tradition.
Absolutely. And flavor and the experience of food is not just about basic sensory perception. It's about things like, as you said, nostalgia. It's about the memories. It's about maybe not being afraid of something that's new. It's about your expectations and your hopes and dreams and anticipation of what a color might provide you and things like that. So it's easy to knock romanticism and to say that nostalgia is not important or love isn't important in food, but I think it's fundamental, isn't it? But also quite difficult to kind of quantify at the same time. How much does nostalgia, you know, how many extra points of deliciousness do you get from nostalgia in your food? Is that a problem, Morgan, do you think, in terms of you know, companies developing new products and things like that? That you know, it's all very well, you know, taking people into a darkened room and lifting up the barrier and sliding them a bit of plate, but you're ignoring huge aspects of the eating process.
Yeah, I mean, one, you know, part of my job is to work with companies to develop products for the future. I am bad person. So developing products that perhaps I might not eat or that you might not eat, but for a future, perhaps in 5 years' time, because that's, you know, that food development process often takes that long. For those people to want that food, part of it has to connect to their own cultural story. It has to be located in something more than we've got a really good idea, we're going to put it to market anywhere in the world. That's why there is that amount of time, that research about what does it attach to, not just does it taste good, but when people are in that supermarket and they don't have enough time, what's going to make them take that from the shelf as opposed to the other thing? How are they going to diversify from that shopping list? How are they going to pick that new thing? And it's about hooking into all of those things. One of the biggest things is aspiration, especially in Britain. We're extremely aspirational. Unlike a lot of countries in the world, when we make food, they are very much rooted in their culture and their traditions. So it's hard to break in with new products.
Yes,
whereas
absolutely.
For the UK, we are always looking for the next new thing. We like to talk about what we've just had.
So less neophobic, do you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, and also disloyal. Disloyal. Yeah,
some might say more adventurous, but the word disloyal, I guess you can use that as well.
And that.
Yeah. So Neil, I'm just wondering, so just something struck me as we were chatting. What about the foods and food technologies that didn't catch on that maybe should have? I remember there was a company that made sort of bicarb based bread that was very successful briefly and then just sort of drifted away. Jerusalem artichokes, I mean, shouldn't they have been the potato rather than the potato, because they just grow, you can't stop them from growing. Do you think there were opportunities missed?
I think there always are. I think a lot of the time, and I think this is the big problem, and tell me if I'm wrong, actually, in a way, I hope I am wrong. I think a lot of this is somebody comes up with a big idea, sliced bread, they can throw some money at it, develop it quickly, they can throw some money at the advertising, and then it's the best thing since sliced bread. It's just that there it is. And it happens. I mean, Coca-Cola, I mean, you can pick a load of examples, you know, where, I mean, Coca-Cola, I'm going to put my hands up and I love Diet Coke. I hang my head in shame, but they've got me. And I know it's a bit crap. Coke is actually a bit crap. It's not that great, but they were so good at getting the advertising in there and getting their product into every corner around the world very cheaply. So I always think that there's so many things that haven't been harnessed because there wasn't some cynical man who saw it and ran with it. So, yeah, I mean, but it's one of those things, it's like, can I list a load of things that haven't been invented? Well, no, because they haven't been invented. And I wish I could think of those things. But yeah, there's countless opportunities. And I think, actually, a lot of the things that, certainly from the point of view of Britain anyway, but I wasn't going to speak for the rest of the world, is something that we are thinking of as a bit of a new fad. And that's things like live ferments, which are, if there's going to be any innovation, I think, put in, or should be put in, and this has been missed for absolutely thousands of years because it hasn't been done yet, and that's to get truly kind of wild yeasts and bacteria, that kind of proper wild fermented food back into our kitchens. If someone can do that, we've evolved two things when it comes to our diet. One is to eat cooked food. If we eat raw food, we die of malnutrition. All these people are into raw food. It's nonsense. We've evolved to have cooked food because it's essentially pre-digested for us.
Yeah, and that's what evolution is. You know, we started off hundreds of thousands of years ago, and we've now
become our abdomens have shrunk. Eat cooked food.
That's part of our evolution. Yeah absolutely. I'd just like to point out, actually, as an editorial point, that there are lots of other crap cola-based drinks available on the
that
market.
That's true.
Just to make that nice and clear. So you've done that classic historical thing of relating the future to the past. So let's dive in there, Morgan. Let's talk about the future, really. Let's talk about the present day, because I think some futuristic ideas are coming to fruition now. And I'm thinking the obvious one is the meat alternative industry. There are lots of plant-based alternatives around. There's also lab-grown meat, algae-based proteins and things like that. Are you excited about this area, or has the horse bolted? Is the moment of excitement past?
It feels old to me, that, yeah. Feels a bit old, but I'm just...
But you are a futurologist, so I guess you were.
I think everybody now, it's there, isn't it? I mean, it's really got some shelf space. It's in the conversation. I remember just being in New York recently, and everybody who I hung out with and saw at work or pleasure, none of them were vegan, and every single one of them had plant-based milk in their coffee.
Absolutely.
And I thought, it's just become, you have to be in a group to have these choices. And I think that's what it's provided. It's given everyone options because people just might like those vegan sausages and actually still like a steak. So I think that's where we're at right now.
Is there something satisfying for you, though, in the fact that it was seen as so futuristic that it was almost ridiculous, and now it's come real? Is there a part of you that goes, yep, yeah, that's how it works?
I suppose when you put it like that, I think that every single thing that's, often when I talk about things that are coming, I've said some things that I'm still saying some things that make people raise their eyebrows. Now, that's, it's nothing to do with me. And I just think that it's very hard for people to think about not being in the present now, where this particular aesthetic is cool, this particular thing that they like is cool. How will I ever not wear this item of clothing and I not think it's great? And of course, things move on, which is why tattoos are always dangerous, isn't it? because our choices and our preferences change. And that's the same with food, because I think food is just it's very much a social, transient thing. I don't think we know what we like. I mean, and I actually really believe that. I think that we can be influenced and that can change all the time. And our taste buds, they do change as we evolve and we age. And, of course, they die. Like we do. And so I think that I don't think it's so fixed. And I think the future is always unexpected. And going back to what Neil was saying about fermentation, the biggest thing in food innovation right now in food tech is process fermentation, which is really being put into industry, and it's changing the way that food is produced. And I think it's huge.
It's not a fad. It's part of our makeup. Yeah. We have to be healthy. We have to have cooked food, and we have to have live fermented food.
Yeah.
It's not a fad, but I think we think of it in the UK as a bit of a fad, as a bit of this foreign thing that has just come in. And we've really got to address it.
Yeah. And looking back, I mean, Neil, the you know, there have been developments all along the way. I mentioned the Columbian Exchange, but, you know, the introduction of tomatoes and corn and all sorts of different products like that. I mean, are there other things that are likely to make a comeback? As you say, fermentation, we've been doing it for years, salting, you know, pickling and things like that. It's an age-old tradition that's coming back. Is there a part of the future which is all so firmly rooted in the past, do you think?
I think our innovations have already existed. Whatever future innovations are coming that are going to work have already existed. You know, we make a big deal about eating organic food, and when you think about it, we've only actually had chemical fertilizers and whatnot for 150 years? So out of the million years humans have been about, there's been 200 years where our food hasn't been organic and it hasn't been organically grown. Mm. We think of this as amazing, an amazing thing. It's not.
Yeah. Rediscovering these amazing beans. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And people are looking now. You know, our soils are so exhausted and they're full of so many chemicals now that people have realised if you go to traditional techniques, mixed farming, you know, we have more than one crop in one field, and you do low intensity, you can actually have pretty good yields. You can, if you don't shoot your dairy calves, who are male, as soon as they're born, you can have veal, high welfare veal, where they're running around in fields, not in crates and stuff. That's illegal in this country. You can't do that. You know, our farming's messed up. Male chicks all get ground down within the first 24 hours of, you know, of being alive. As soon as they realise that they're males and don't lay eggs, they're sent to an incinerator. Whereas in the past, we didn't eat hens because they laid eggs. We let the cockerels run around, or capons run around, as they were called.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they had a nice life for a couple of years, and then we ate them. And it's our ultra, I don't know, what's the right word? Everything's so finely tuned to make a profit at any cost that all this other stuff that is really important has just evaporated. And I think all you have to do is look 200 or 300 years in the past when the population is still quite big. And you may realise that we live in cities now. We can't have a pig. But go back a couple of hundred years and you realise that actually we can use these older technologies or reuse them and repurpose them for life today.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a fair amount of repurposing and reusing, and I hear what you say, that there's, you know, in a sense, you know, there's not so much innovation as regeneration of ideas, but there is also, Morgan, new technology as well, things like CRISPR, gene editing technology and things like that, which are developing strains of crops which could be really useful in some areas. But they're very controversial, aren't they? What's your view on CRISPR? I mean, CRISPR is very different from GM, but can give us a little bit of a précis of that world.
Well, I think that one of the things that we forget is that, just like Neil said, it's not new. It's actually been going on for quite a while. And the thing is, because we don't know about it as consumers, we think it's fine. But a lot of our food, in fact, some of our foods that we've accepted as normal are already, they're completely man-made creations, like, I don't know, iceberg lettuce or rainbow trout or seedless products, things like that. So we know that a lot of, you know, we almost don't want to know the truth because it eliminates a lot of the foods that people are choosing to eat. But I think that there's so much food tech in our world, in our supermarkets, and even when we buy seeds, you know, that's why there's seed banks, to keep the pure seeds. And even some of the seeds in the seed banks, they found, are already modified. So, and I think, going back to what Neil said really early on, you know, we're living in a false economy in many ways, because a lot of that stuff which is trying to produce more food for more profit ultimately is so short-sighted, because in some way in this whole ecosystem it's disrupted. So there's lots of technology coming, you know, happening or going into the future. Some of it's fantastic because we know that we have a ton of food waste, and there's ways in which we can use that food waste, even just with digital printing. We can turn things that look like slop into something that looks really she and high-end. we know that the, I mean, one of the biggest things is the money in the waste right now for every business is phenomenal. So whether that's the runoff from the yogurt making process, cheese making process, milk, all the stuff that goes off, that can be turned into fabric, that can be turned into things that can be used to stop us harvesting cotton, for example. Things yeah. like apple peel, orange peel, coffee grounds, I mean, used cooking oil, all four materials for product. There's just so many things. Skins from fish being used for lots of things, including burn victims, but also for fabrics. There's just so many uses for a lot of stuff that we've thrown away in the processing. And I think, you know, in terms of technology, it's a phenomenal development because one of the things we're becoming more aware, but what we've, and so in some ways that's confronting and frightening for people because we suddenly feel like, oh my goodness, the world is, you know, the end is nigh. But we also have been bobbing along for the last 15, 20 years, wasting everything, probably much longer, wasting everything, not yeah. caring because we haven't been confronted with it. And now we're being confronted.
So I guess it's a circular economy, isn't it?
Yeah.
That people are talking about that, you know, I mean, the big thing, of course, in the news for the last 10 years or so has been plastics and the fact that manufacturers of plastics or companies that produce something in plastic packaging are never culpable for what happened to that packaging at all. So that there's never been that closed circular system. Is that really where we need to be then? That we need to make sure if we produce something, that all the byproducts, or as many of the byproducts as possible, has some other use, because otherwise we're just throwing away energy and creating pollution.
Yes, and also I think that there's whatever we produce, even when people say, oh, well, it's recyclable, even that's a production in itself. So how do you recycle it? What's the produce? So that's where everything...
Have you enabled that?
Yes. Yeah. So then it's more technology, it's more energy resources, it's, you know, what's that process? So that's, I think, why we're looking at the future being refills, reusing, refilling, because everything like the idea around recycling now, it feels really old as well, because that can be 25 years in landfill. So what does that really mean? Biodegradable? How long does it take? What's the process in that?
It's biodegradable. It might take 1,000 years, but it will.
Eventually will
Anything
go.
Anything carbon-based is biodegradable eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. So Neil, I mean, what's interesting here is that sustainability has now become not just a moral imperative, but a financial one as well. There are justifications within the economics of a food company to push sustainability and to make their products sustainable. And you mentioned profit making as a reductionist tool in the food industry. But I mean, I would say 'twas ever thus, wasn't it? I mean, you know, the peasant farming their field, you know, in 300 years ago was probably, you know, it was about making ends meet as well. They weren't doing it for anyone's good. They were either doing it because they had to or to survive. I mean, is profit always the driver of innovation, or is the morality and tradition and romanticism part of it as well, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, these things aren't mutually exclusive, but we're told for some reason that they are mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. Like, well, you know, we want cheap food. Well, you can't have cheap food unless we scale up, unless we really, you know, if you pay people a decent wage, well, your food's going to go up. So, you know, we're told, and we really lap it up, especially in this country again, we want the cheapest food. But that's the cheapest food is the best food. The cheapest thing is the best thing. And it's total nonsense. You can have appropriately made, that's going to be different for whatever you're making. It might be organic, it might be zero plastic, it might be high welfare or fair trade. You know, when fair trade first came in, or was being mooted, MPs were saying the hardworking British people aren't going to pay 3p more for their chocolate bar or whatever. And actually, we did. You know, because they showed that, yeah, it is a little bit more expensive, but actually, given the choice, most of us would do that. It didn't triple in price. It wasn't out of our reach. So I think we can make these changes. There's a huge amount of dismantling to be done, sometimes so much, I think, that it just seems like an impossible impossible task, I suppose. That's what, from a personal point of view, I kind of gnash my teeth over, I suppose.
You don't say.
I think that with the pricing of things, like you're saying about the false economies, that it's only in the last, I'd say, I don't know, 40 years, almost since that packet meal thing happened, also Britain, almost like it's kept following that curve, that our expectation to spend less and less of our income on food has become our norm. So that I think something like in the 1970s, it was like 80% of our income was on food. So back in the day when you saw there were more housewives, it was more of that social structure where women were trying to make ends meet to make a meal for the family by the end of the week, which is why the Sunday roast kind of lasted for 5 days. It became a pie and a stew and a whatever as it went on. So that's great. And I think that those ideas are a bit lost because we're wasting, because it's cheaper. So we've got into a different habit around food where we can afford to waste it and not eat it and don't have the kind of structure in our home about it's connected to the cooking, it's connected to how we connect to our food. I know it sounds like a bit of a moral kind of lecturing, but, you know, it's just where we are as a culture.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's look to the future now because we're running out of time a little bit. What are you excited about for the future, Morgan? I mean, there have been lots of things that have sort of come across my desk and disappeared again. 3D printing rings a bell. I mean, I think there is an application for it, but I suspect that's relatively small scale. What are the innovations that you've seen that you like the look of?
Yeah, just the thing with 3D printing, I think it's much more apparent in factories. It's much more apparent now in industry, as opposed to something that necessarily will have one at home like a microwave. But I'm excited.
So what is being 3D? Sorry, what is being? This is just so bizarre. What is being 3D printed?
Morgan, you can explain this one.
I've not heard of it.
Oh, it's because there's quite a lot of things. I mean, it lends itself brilliantly to any kind of sugar craft. So anything intricate.
Oh, okay.
So any kind of makes like that is brilliant because it can create, what it does brilliantly is it puts space into things. And that for me is, leads me on to what I think is the best innovation coming is air. So I think that our biggest thing in the future that's going to kind of hit everybody and be used in so many ways is air. And I think it's already being used, and 3D printing does that, puts air into things. What it does, enables us to use less commodity. So, for example, chocolate, if we 3D print it, we can make a shape, touches all the corners of the mouth, makes us feel like we're having a fulfilling mouth of chocolate. But most of it, of course, is air. It's like Curly Whirly advanced.
Yeah. It's the aero sort of approach, I guess, isn't it? But done with more specific. And you know, when I've talked to food companies who say, everyone says that we're trying to put loads of e-numbers in our food. That's the most expensive bit. What we want to put in food, you know, if we want to cut costs, is water and air.
Yes,
But I think what you're saying, Morgan, is that using it as a sensory perception tool, so you still have the structure of something where you don't want to have as many calories. And you get the mouthfeel and all those different things, but the substance of it is different.
Yes, and it's beautiful and it's high end, but actually it's less commodity, so it does not so expensive. But then the advancement of that is air protein, and I think that's going to change the face of all of our proteins.
What is air protein?
So you're taking CO2, you're adding some bacteria, microbes. A little, you know, there's a few, but obviously I don't know the whole science behind it. It's pretty technical, but what is incredible about it is, I mean, it's still in the development stage right now, but there's a massive race in Silicon Valley to get this thing to market that's going to be affordable, is that what they're saying is that you can order your air protein, tons and tons and tons of it. I don't mean you personally, but a factory, an organization, and within 2 hours they can produce it. So there's no waste. It's to order. And it can be turned into any kind of alternative protein that you want it to be. It's cheap because it can obviously airs everywhere, so it can be harvested everywhere around the world. It doesn't impact on any commodities. It kind of is like the perfect solution. Until it's got to actually happen yet, but there's a lot of investment. There's a lot of talk around it. And
so it's like some kind of photosynthesizing bacteria or something that can get the carbon dioxide out of the air and make that into a food, like plants, but make it a high protein food.
It's using the carbon It's using the carbon dioxide, actually. So
right.
And so that's the kind of, because it's everywhere and it's limitless. Yeah.
I feel a new podcast coming on to discuss exactly this subject. Anything else, Morgan? Other products or tools or colours or you know, what's exciting you about the coming 10 years? You must be asked this all the time. I know you're probably bored sick of the question, but it bears being asked.
Because I'm thinking about one of the things that I'm seeing as a massive shift is not necessarily the food or the fad itself as an endpoint, but how we ourselves are going to have changed so much since 2020, and how we are as consumers changing. And now I'm seeing this commodity shift, this way of being from hundreds of years of having, which has been like a human driving, which is about profit and all of the things that companies have to do, to having a new value system. And it's around kindness and community, and it's shifting, and it will shift everything. It will, the ways that companies will behave are going to be called out. And I think that that's what's going to rise to the top.
So this is beyond sustainability. This is the currency of kindness. That's a very exciting idea.
And I think that that's what we're going to see. And because of that, it will change, because food is, I just always think that food is just an expression of what's happening societally. And I think that that's the biggest, for me, that's what's most exciting, is what's happening societally now. We're in such a pivot point. We can't actually, because we're in it, it's always very hard to see it, especially now we've been really spinning, because 2020 was such a shock for people without any kind of roadmap. I've always put a marker in from 2019 when I talked about 2020. I said that the next point of change or reflection would be March 2023. So here we are. And I think that we are now just about to take time to look back, reflect and consolidate. And something is shifting in that, and that we're in an amorphous time. And I think that we are restructuring our future perspectives and values.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, to be honest. I think we've really reassessed things. We've had time to think, time to reflect, as you say. And I think people, what the tide is beginning to turn, I think, on people wanting control back in their lives. And I think food is possibly the most important aspect there. You know, we've been controlled by, it sounds like some kind of conspiracy theory.
It started here.
But we have essentially been controlled by food manufacturers, you know, told that we won't spend money on this, told we don't have time to do this, that and the other. And we've been given the time to stop and think and do things and go, actually, this isn't half bad. And talking about plant-based stuff before, you know, people think it's great. Oh, it's plant-based, so it's healthy. And they're just swapping a not processed steak for a high processed burger made with a dozen different ultra refined products from all around the world. It's been shipped about, it's caused so much pollution, whatever. And it turns out that a lot of these foods.
It's moral relativity, though, isn't it? Because if some people might say, well, the main reason for me was I didn't want a plant to be, an animal to be killed in the process. And yet you've got to balance that with the other effects on the environment and on wildlife as well.
I mean, I'm trying to eat much less animal products, and I'm doing all right. I mean, I eat a lot of vegan food. But, you know, the whole part of the vegan approach was to eat whole foods and foods that aren't processed, because that's also part of the problem. That's a bit that people seem to be forgetting. And I'm not having a go at people for that. What I'm saying is food manufacturers are making ultra-processed food, which is bad for us, got more fat, more calories, more trans fats, whatever in there than any meat product does. And we're saying that's healthy. It's going to be the next scandal.
Well, let's not look at the next scandal now, because, Neil, you're a historian, so it is, strictly speaking, illegal for you to talk about the future, but I will allow it right here and now. Historians have a fascinating view of the future because you're relating to things that have happened in the past, I guess. What are you excited about with the future of food? Are there things that you've spotted that where you either think, oh, yes, that makes sense because it's part of a cycle from history, or are there brand new things that you haven't really seen before that excite you from your own personal point of view, as much as, you know, as a food historian?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, I've spent time being a chef as well. So a lot of the time, these ideas and things that I I think of it more from a practical point of view. And for me, it's around food waste, I think is the important thing. And I think it's again, trying to give back choices to us. You know, you go around the supermarket and you have packets, usually wrapped in plastic, of, I don't know, apples, that, or actually it's things like plums that are nowhere near ripe, but they've gone past their best before date and they're being sold for 5p and no one buys them, they get thrown away. I think lifting these crazy laws where we're throwing away good food has to go. And I think it's shifting. Yeah. It's shifting, but I don't think... I think supermarkets are getting rid of best before dates on fresh fruit and vegetables. Or is it just a couple of them?
It's by choice, yes.
Whereas if you... I mean, if you... Yeah, if you go to a greengrocer's, there's never been a best before date, ever. You go there and you look at the thing and you go, that's nice, I'll buy that one. That's not nice, I won't buy it.
You don't like big companies, do you?
I really don't like big companies, no.
Okay, and so again, I guess you're relating back to what Morgan said. So sustainability issues are the things that are exciting for you?
Yeah, and I realise it's... I mean, you're walking a tightrope because, at the same, you know, cheap food means there's less food poverty. You know, I realise that I'm saying all this stuff and people go, well, hang on a minute.
Easy for you to say, yeah.
It's very easy for me to say. But, you know, I went through several years of having no money at all and having to really cook on the breadline, literally. So what I'm saying is it can be done. We're losing skills. We need to get skills back. And I think innovation needs to happen in home economics, I suppose. And that's not necessarily a department for the, you know, the mum of the house or the female of the house, which traditionally I think is something that can be shared within a family. And I think getting that family would share back, me, yeah. Taking responsibility, again, yeah, for your own food, not being told what to eat, eating what you like and doing it properly, and getting that, just the community of the family back again. And family is a loose term, you know. There's a lot of different ways of having a family and not just talking about nuclear families. I think that's it's not really an innovation, I suppose, but it's
but it's a change.
It's putting it in schools, though, isn't it? It's putting just basic cooking skills, food knowledge into schools where some kids just haven't been exposed to that at all and will never be exposed to it, perhaps, in their lifetime. And
it does seem bizarre that the government has been so reluctant to push forward on in that area.
Exactly. It's not rocket science. It's something absolutely. Not hard. It's not expensive. And yet there is stuff as complicated as rocket science. Try to be, you know, innovated, like lab-grown meat and all that nonsense.
Yeah. Okay, we need to wrap this up. So I've got one final question for you, for which I need a brief answer, please. Morgan, if you had to pick one food industry innovation since sliced bread, which we now think is a lackluster kind of concept, but over the last 100 years, what would you choose as the best thing that's happened in the food industry or in food?
Oh, gosh. Can I answer last? I don't really know. I mean, I wish I had like a one thing answer. It's definitely not the cupcake or avocado on toast, God's sake.
It could also be very personal. You know, what about your favourite thing rather than the most impactful or the most important? You know, what's your favourite thing that's cropped up? The invention that's either made your food life richer or just you just adore because it's delicious.
Well, the thing I love seaweed. And so for me, the thing that's been great for me personally is that probably early 90s in Britain, we suddenly allowed to our minds to be expanded enough to say, Japanese food? Okay, go on, I'm going to do it. And, you know, that whole thing of disgusting raw fish, British people don't eat that rubbish kind of idea, that foreign muck or whatever, you know, the kind of ideas were at the time. And then suddenly it's on every shelf in Tesco's. So I think that normalising of Japanese food, for me personally, is great. So
yeah, and hopefully it's had an impact beyond the, you know, the simple fact of it being there. Okay, very good. Neil, what about you? If you had just a bit one food or food industry innovation, what's the best thing since the lackluster slicing of bread?
I would say the digital thermometer probe.
Oh, very good. Yeah, absolutely. Very good for jam making. I used mine just the other day to make some crab apple jelly.
Well, I mean,
and wine,
I use it absolutely all the time. So from a personal point of view, like I mentioned before, I taught myself how to cook. I didn't know what the cues were for, I don't know, medium cooked steak or meat. I didn't know all the ways it should feel and all that kind of stuff. So I could use the thermometer probe to basically, I could say, well, I think this is ready, and then I would use it, and it helped me gain the experience and the skills how to cook. So from a personal point of view, I think it was really important. And then as I moved to become a professional chef, and I worked in kitchens where you're extremely busy, extremely stressed, that thermometer probe is just, it's making sure you don't kill anybody at the end of the day. And you can make sure things that are hot are appropriately hot, or the things that are cold are appropriately cold. And I think anybody who eats out, you know, it's saved many, many lives, and it's allowed chefs to do more and more complex and fun and exciting things and do it safely and reduce things like food waste, because you're keeping things at the appropriate temperatures and that kind of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I remember once I had to make a Yorkshire Christmas pie, which has about 10 different animals in it. It was weighed about 10 stone. It took three of us to carry it. If I did not have a... And it just, you know, in the past, people used to make massive, great big pies, and I had to bake it for 14 hours to make sure it was a sensible temperature inside. Mm. 300 years ago, how people were judging that, and then the skills that they must have had to do, or must have had to have had to do that successfully and not kill people, were phenomenal. And it turns out, actually, they did kill people.
Yeah, it was just a collateral damage on the way to get to a great steak, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, it is. So
that's my effort,
the humble thermometer probe.
Thermometer probe. Fantastic. Well, for me, the best thing since sliced bread is the two of you. So thank you so much for your time. Do you like what I've done there? So Mogyan Gay and Neil Buttery, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.